Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Last week we heard about some pillars of personal health. Adhering to just four simple healthy lifestyle factors can have a strong impact on the prevention of chronic diseases. Not smoking, not being obese, getting a half hour of exercise a day, and eating healthier. And eating healthier is defined as consuming more fruits, veggies, and whole grains, and less meat. These four factors alone account for 78% of chronic disease risk. This is good news for all of us who want more control over our health. This is also a useful example of epidemiology, the science that distinguishes public health from all other disciplines. Epidemiology is the study and analysis of the distribution and determinants of health and disease conditions in defined populations. And today I'd like to riff on some epidemiology. And where else but WAKT, We Act Radio 106.1 FM Toledo, where will you hear riffs on epidemiology? Of these four simple healthy lifestyle factors, not smoking, not being obese, getting a half hour of exercise a day, and eating healthier, I focused last week on diet. And most people have some awareness of the importance of diet and exercise in healthy living. One thing common between diet and exercise is their role in maintaining a healthy body weight. Both a healthy diet and exercise are dose-dependent, meaning that they offer progressive benefits with progressive improvements in diet and more exercise. But how about the relative importance of diet versus exercise in health? It turns out that diet is even more important than exercise. Perhaps the easiest way to illustrate this is a study of heart health, where the heart health of sedentary vegans was compared to marathon runners eating typical American diets. The sedentary vegans, with little physical activity, but eating an exclusively plant-based diet, had better heart health than marathon runners eating a mixed diet with animal-based foods such as meat, eggs, cheese, and butter. Fortunately, the benefits of a healthy diet and generous amounts of exercise are additive, so please do both. But let's return to the remaining healthy lifestyle factors that we didn't talk about last show. That is not smoking. Not smoking is part of a pillar of health of avoiding toxins, which would also include avoiding the abusive use of alcohol and drugs. Tobacco use is the leading preventable cause of death in the United States, tripling your death rate, causing almost 500,000 premature deaths each year, with about 40,000 of those deaths due to secondhand smoke. Excessive alcohol use causes about 88,000 premature deaths a year. Over 100,000 Americans are killed by drug overdoses each year, the majority from opioids. Still, five times as many Americans are killed each year from legal drug use than illegal drug use. That is, from tobacco and alcohol use than illegal drugs like opioids, and cocaine. Of course, not all deaths are the same. Some deaths happen at a much earlier age. Someone dying at 85 is very different than someone dying at 25. In public health, we use something called years of potential life lost, which helps take into account the amount of premature death, say by counting the years lost before age 75 in a death. Using this method, we get a different perspective on premature death. For instance, when considering premature death, cancer overtakes heart disease as the number one killer in America. Also, deaths from injuries jump up in the rankings of premature killers. This is true for both intentional injuries, that is, homicide and suicide, and from unintentional injuries, such as from motor vehicles, falls, poisonings, and drownings. Please note that public health folks don't use the term accidents. We prefer the term injuries because injuries have causes that can be ascertained and possibly prevented. They aren't simply accidents. If you like, you can include protection from violent injury, a social toxin, under the pillar of health of avoiding toxins. Now, back to not all deaths being the same. Even considering the tragedy of premature death, some deaths are much more traumatic, both physically and socially. For instance, violence and drug overdoses add a whole different layer of trauma to a community's health. Further, different forms of death may have very different social meanings. For example, homicide gets far more attention than suicide, yet suicide is more common than murder. While suicide is tragic and baffling, the larger community tends to view it as less threatening than murder. This may be in part because murder strikes at most people's sense of personal safety more than does suicide. Statistically, you are more of a threat to kill yourself than to be killed by anyone else. We greatly underestimate the risk of suicide compared to other risks of fatal injury. For example, even in high-risk occupations, suicide is a greater threat than direct occupational risks. Firemen and women are more likely to kill themselves than be killed in a fire. Policemen and policewomen are more likely to kill themselves than be killed by a criminal. Those in the military are more likely to kill themselves than be killed in combat. High-risk occupations do have higher rates of suicide due to higher levels of stress and depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. Still, doctors and dentists have higher suicide rates than police officers. There's more one way that an occupation can kill you. Discussions of health typically focus on physical health problems. Unfortunately, mental health issues get neither equal nor adequate attention. For instance, depression is the most common and disabling threat that Americans experience. Depression robs us of untold measures of quality of life. Up until now, in this riff of epidemiology, I have focused mostly on mortality, which, while a very hard endpoint, can somewhat miss the point of a quality of life. For every mortality, there is much morbidity, that is, disease and suffering. Disability casts a long shadow. For example, for every gun death, there are 6 people shot and injured, often with long-term physical and mental damage. Further, health is more than the mere absence of disease, disability, and suffering. So I want to touch on another area that serves as a pillar of health. That area is rest and resiliency. Sleep is the most obvious example that we all share of restorative health. The CDC considers lack of sleep a public health epidemic. Sleep deprivation can lead to a number of serious health problems, including obesity, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, depression, and even heart attack and stroke. Because sleep deprivation shortens our attention span and reduces alertness, can also lead to car crashes, industrial accidents, and other occupational hazards. Almost 1 in 3 American adults say that they are sleeping less than 6 hours each night. Most adults should be getting between 7 and 9 hours of sleep each night. Lack of sleep undercuts our body and mind's ability to maintain health. Within the pillar of health that is rest and resiliency is social support and purpose. This includes loving and supportive relationships and things like personal passion and positive attitude. By the way, you did hear that right. Love is a public health issue. Even one loving relationship can serve as a powerful buffer against the stresses of life. Developing passions and positive attitudes can also serve us well to propel us through life's difficulties. I will try to speak of such things more on this show. Better yet, I'll try to model such things. Let me review those pillars of health. A healthy diet with more fruits, veggies, and whole grains and less meat. Maintaining a healthy body weight. Physical activity. Avoiding toxins like smoking and abusive use of alcohol and drugs. Maintaining environment free of violence and injuries. Getting adequate sleep. Maintaining loving and supportive relationships, and developing personal passions and a positive attitude. Here at Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health, the people's health is not academic. You're listening to WAKT, We Act, 106.1 FM Toledo, your local and slightly loco non-commercial radio station. Now let's switch gears a bit and get with our public health news and research roundup.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
Let's start our Roundup with why pedestrian deaths are at a 30-year high from NPR. Across the U.S., 6,227 pedestrians died in traffic accidents. There's that word, accidents, in 2018, the highest number in nearly 30 years. The real increase comes from large trends, drivers and pedestrians distracted by their phones, and a growth of larger vehicles on the road. Population growth like jaywalking isn't central to the problem. We've spent decades building a transportation system that's designed for cars and not for people. Something accounts for the 30% jump in pedestrian deaths in just the last 10 years. Looking at the various metrics available, the ones that pop out are distraction related to smartphone use and the market share increase in SUVs. Since 2013, the number of consumers buying light trucks has far outpaced those buying cars. There's no question that pedestrians hit by SUVs are more likely to die than those hit by a car. SUVs are bigger, heavier, and deadlier to pedestrians. Compounding that problem are smartphones. Both walkers and drivers use cell phone data 4,000% more than they did in 2008, which means they aren't watching the roads. We know that the human is the cause of most crashes, actually 94% of crashes, meaning there is room, much room, for improvement in behavior. Distraction can mean a lot of things. It's not just the phone. You're putting on lipstick on, or you're eating, or things like that can distract you from driving. Florida is considering legislation that would allow police to ticket drivers for any type of distracted driving, including petting your dog or yelling at your kids. That type of law exists in 5 out of the 6 New England states, which saw overall a 36% drop in fatalities last year. Rhode Island alone dropped from 10 fatalities in 2017 to just 4 last year, a 60% decrease. This points to the effectiveness of enforcement in changing behavior. Well, I have a personal connection to this story. I've been without a car for the last 5 years, and I try to bike whenever I can. This is up to my game and my love affair with Mother Earth, and it's a great way to get an invigorating workout, but it also brings distinct risks. I ride mostly on the sidewalks, mostly because tons of these huge motorized behemoths are traveling around at high speeds relative to me, and they often seem to be nearly driverless, and not driverless in a good way. My experience is that it's difficult to ride my bike a mile in the city without a car violating my right-of-way. The violation of my right-of-way by a car occurs more often than I have to deal with right-of-way issues with another pedestrian. Apparently, not too many people travel by foot much either. I would say that most bike rides I take in the city, I don't even see another bike. The reality is that I pretty much assume that every driver is distracted. This does actually reinforce a practice of mindfulness on my part, with the motivating force of pay attention or die. When cars and pedestrians are involved, the law of the jungle dictates that the pedestrian loses. However, there are traffic laws applicable to bikes. This from the Ohio Bar Association. Bicycles are defined as vehicles under Ohio law. State law allows bicycles to be lawfully operated on virtually all Ohio roads except freeways or certain limited access roadways. Therefore, cyclists who ride their bikes on roadways aren't in line with Ohio law. Same rights, same roads, same rules is the mantra cyclists follow. Like all states, Ohio law requires cyclists to follow the basic rules of the road when riding a bicycle on a roadway. Like any vehicle operator, a bicyclist must ride with traffic, obey basic traffic laws, stop at stop signs and red lights, and follow all traffic control devices. When following the rules of the road, a cyclist has exactly the same right-of-way as any car, truck, or bus driver. Ohio does have a few bike-specific laws. The key bike law in Ohio states that a bicycle must be operated as near to the right side of the road as practicable. While the word practicable is undefined, the law states that a cyclist does not have to ride along the right side of the lane when it is unreasonable or unsafe to do so. Some examples of when a cyclist may use the entire lane include when it is necessary to avoid fixed objects or parked cars, surface hazards, or moving vehicles. A big exception to the ride to the right rule is if the lane is too narrow for the bicycle and an overtaking vehicle to travel safely side by side within the lane. In such a situation, the cyclist is not required to stay to the right. Cyclists are also permitted to ride two abreast, meaning side by side, in the same lane. Ohio law does not require cyclists to move out of the way for faster traffic. Traffic law allows motorists to cross a double yellow line to pass any slower vehicle, but only if the slower vehicle is traveling at less than the posted speed limit, the faster vehicle is capable of passing the slower vehicle without exceeding the posted speed limit, and there is sufficient sight distance ahead to permit the passing maneuver to be safely accomplished, taking into account the speed of the slower vehicle. This is not specifically a bicycle law, but rather a law that covers passing vehicles such as slower moving tractors and Amish buggies. However, it does apply to bicycles. If a motorist can follow the listed rules as to pass a cyclist while crossing a double yellow line, they are free to do so. Cyclists are not required to use bike lanes. These lanes are typically created by local governments and are not governed specifically by state law. State law mandates only that cities may not force cyclists to use the sidewalks. Allowing bicyclists the courtesy of traveling as a motor vehicle is surely an honorable law. However, in the city of Toledo, any bicyclist over the age of 15 is supposed to stay off the sidewalks and ride in the streets. As for me, no matter how urban or urbane Toledo may be, when I am on a bike, Toledo looks a lot like a jungle, and I, for one, will respect the laws of the jungle, and I ain't lying. Well, fellow travelers in the jungle of a world, here's another story related to the dangers of distracted driving. Bans on texting while behind the wheel, making roads safer, from usnews.com. When a state bans texting while driving, will the number of car crash victims showing up in its emergency rooms drop? New research suggests the answer is yes. States that have full bans in place had an average of 8% fewer car crash victims seen in emergency rooms. People tend to think these bans as inconvenience, but they actually do have public health benefits. Distracted driving is dangerous for the drivers, passengers, other drivers, and pedestrians who may suffer the consequences of a crash caused by not paying attention to the road. I would like to add that, as startling as thousands of deaths due to distracted driving is, for every death there are over 100 injuries. Yep, you heard that right. For every death, an additional 100 injuries. Distracted driving may not kill you, but it will mess up hundreds of thousands of Americans each year. Next up, two top medical groups call for soda taxes and advertising curbs on sugary drinks. This is from the New York Times. Two of the country's leading medical groups issued a call to arms against the soda industry, urging legislatures and policymakers to embrace taxes, warning labels, and advertising restrictions to deter young people from consuming the sugary beverages that are increasingly linked to the nation's crisis of obesity and chronic disease. Describing sweetened drinks as a grave health threat to children and adolescents, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Heart Association issued a set of bold policy recommendations they say are necessary to stem the epidemic of type 2 diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, and other diet-related illnesses responsible for tens of thousands of premature deaths and billions of dollars in annual health care costs. The organizations say such measures are needed if the United States is to adhere to federal dietary guidelines recommending that added sugars make up less than 10% of the total calories consumed by children and adolescents. The figure now stands at 17%, with nearly half of that coming from sugary sports drinks, carbonated sodas, and fruit-flavored beverages. The guidelines do not include sugars found naturally in 100% fruit juices. Sugary drinks are empty calories, and they are the low-hanging fruit in the fight against childhood obesity. The statement, more than 2 years in the making, reflects the growing sense of urgency among doctors and the frustration over what many describe as government inaction in the face of a national health emergency. The recommendations embrace a range of initiatives, like federal curbs on junk food advertising and measures like soda taxes that have been effective in reducing soda consumption. Most are likely to face resistance from the powerful beverage industry, which has fought back vigorously against any government efforts to dampen consumption of sugar-laden drinks. Still, some of the policy suggestions would be relatively easy to achieve, like increased funding for public education programs to highlight the dangers of excess sugar consumption, or changes to the federal food program that serves millions of poor children. The Supplemental Nutrition Program, or SNAP, pays for 20 million servings of sugary drinks a day at an annual cost of $4 billion. Barring recipients from using benefits to buy unhealthy beverages could prevent 52,000 deaths from type 2 diabetes alone. Other small symbolic steps they recommend could have an outsized impact, like encouraging healthcare institutions to remove sugary drinks from cafeteria menus and vending machines. William Dermody, a spokesman for the American Beverage Association, said that there are better ways to discourage sugar consumption among children. The industry, he noted, was focused on creating healthier products, including bottled water and low-sugar drinks, part of an industry initiative to cut by 20% the calorie count in beverages by 2025. Jim Krieger, executive director of Healthy Food America, said the industry could not be trusted to oversee the consumption of the unhealthy products it depends on for profits. The initiative to voluntarily reduce the sugar content in beverages was off to a slow start, with only a 3% reduction since the effort began in 2014. Federal studies have also shown that beverage companies spend a disproportionate share of their marketing dollars on campaigns aimed at minority youth, and researchers say such advertisement has been growing in recent years despite a voluntary industry-wide initiative to reduce ads for unhealthy products. Many public health advocates have called for federal regulation, much like the 1971 rule that banned cigarette ads on radio and television. The medical associations acknowledged that such restrictions would face an uphill battle, but suggested Congress could modify tax laws that allowed beverage companies to deduct advertising costs for unhealthy food and beverages. State governments, they added, could enact rules that ban the marketing of such foods and around schools and prohibit the makers of sugary drinks from sponsoring youth sporting events. A study found that soda taxes, if widely enacted, could prevent more than 500,000 cases of childhood obesity. Faced with a surge in local soda taxes, the industry has been backing so-called preemptive legislation at the state level that prohibits municipalities from creating taxes on foods and beverages. This effort has been successful in states including California, Michigan, and Washington. And a commentary on this from Food Politics blog: this action of the American Association of Pediatrics is truly remarkable. In 2015, this academy was heavily criticized for taking funding from Coca-Cola, and surely not coincidentally saying little about the need for children to reduce consumption of sugary drinks. Once exposed, the academy said it would no longer accept that funding. I did, however, hear an alternative story. Coca-Cola officials told me that as a result of their transparency initiative, the company would no longer fund the pediatric, dietetic, and family practice academies. It is also hardly a coincidence that now that the association no longer takes money from Coke, it is free to promote soda taxes as a useful public health strategy. And while Americans are scarfing down sugary beverages, this from the Star: liberals' water pledges ring hollow for some British Columbia First Nations still without drinking water. The elected leader of remote First Nation in British Columbia, which has been under a boil water order for 18 years, says he's confident his community will eventually find a solution to its drinking water woes, regardless of which party is elected federally this year. But for some residents of the nine British Columbia bands under decades-long boil water or do not consume advisories, the self-congratulations ring hollow as they still wait for clean water. I think they're trying, I'll give them that. And they say they're spending lots of money on water systems. They are still trying to connect us all into one system, but it hasn't met our standards. Big corporations and governments think that one size fits all. Minister Seamus O'Regan issued a statement proclaiming that everyone should have access to safe, clean, and reliable drinking water, and that his Liberal government has, quote, made progress in lifting 81 long-term advisories. Nine First Nations remained under drinking water advisories in British Columbia. Four are under do not consume orders, which are imposed when a pollutant cannot be removed from the water by boiling. Five others face less stringent boil water notices due to potential biological contaminant. In our beliefs, we're mandated to protect our land and water. As Tsleil-Waututh people, we call ourselves the river people. The water to us is not just something we drink. It's our identity. And in a related story from CBC Canada, people need access to healthy meals. Inequality among Indigenous peoples may explain psychological distress. About 60% of households are harvesting traditional foods. Improving the quality and availability of food could help reduce mental health issues among Indigenous populations in Canada. Suicide is a major cause of death among First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people. Collectively, suicide rates among Indigenous peoples are 2 to 3 times higher than among non-Indigenous Canadians. Now, researchers have looked at how income-related inequalities relate to psychological distress and suicidal behaviors among Indigenous peoples living off-reserve in Canada. Food insecurity, the uncertainty over having a regular, affordable source of nutritious food, seem to be a major factor explaining the higher rates of mental health problems among low-income Indigenous peoples. 28% of off-reserve Indigenous households report some form of it. And we're going to close with an editorial from the Environmental Health Network, an editorial by Dr. Richard Jackson, "When Policymakers Ignore Science, Children Pay the Price." It's time to reject the myth that pouring harmful chemicals and particles into our air won't destroy our children's future. More than a decade ago, I authored a paper warning that the toxic pollutant lead was damaging the brains of our children and costing each year's cohort of American babies hundreds of billions in lifetime income. Today I'm writing because there is mounting evidence that failing to protect our children from air pollution will cost far more. For too long, the powerful damage done by lead exposure to children went first unrecognized and then malignantly unaddressed by those responsible for taking action. Shifting blame to mothers for negligence was a more convenient tactic than taking responsibility for their actions. Why would a good mother have her children living in a slum housing? But lead, unfortunately, was just one of a long list of dangerous hazards that went ignored until it was too late. In the early 1970s, most American newborns were bathed with the germicide hexachlorophene until research discovered that it caused brain damage, nerve damage, and seizures in infants. Mercury was used as teething powder in many households through 1950, until researchers linked the element to serious neurological deficiencies in infants. Many of the protections we rely on today were enacted only after concerned parents and children's advocates fought to advance them. Repeatedly, our society has ignored the health of those most vulnerable among us. Infants may be unable to speak, but they are profoundly sensitive to environmental threats surrounding them. This month, the American Journal of Public Health published an article by a group of scientists, physicians, and children's health advocates urging officials at the federal, state, and local levels to increase efforts to reduce exposure to air pollution in order to protect our children's brains. The article highlights mounting evidence linking air pollution to neurodevelopmental disorders in children like autism, ADHD, memory deficiencies, and reduced IQ. The rate of these disorders is on the rise, and costs the U.S. economy tens of billions of dollars a year in medical costs and lost productivity. Most worrisome for every parent and grandparent in America should be that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, instead of fulfilling its duty to protect our children from environmental harms, has, in the last 2 years, rolled back a multitude of clean air protections, endangering the health and development of our children. Let's not duplicate the selfish blunders of the past. It's time to reject the myth that pouring harmful chemicals and particles into our air won't destroy our children's future. That does it for today. If you have any questions or comments you'd like to share with me, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's wakt@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.